hoping he was going to tell us what the band was doing. Mel referred to me as a gracious lady. That's why I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sick and tired of being a tramp. I was sick and tired of being a drunk. I wanted to be a lady. And if I've turned into a gracious one, that's a bonus. I want to thank the committee for inviting me. I'm not a big convention speaker. I've been out only a few times. And I love it. You know, it appeals to the ego a little bit. And this particular conference has been, I must say, the most treasured in my thoughts and in, it will be in my memories. The first phone call from Stan, and I found out later that he'd made about 6 phone calls in order to get to me. He didn't have my phone number, and my group wouldn't give it to him, you know. And he called a couple other people, and they said, no, we don't give out that information. So, but several people told me about this call that was going around town looking for me. So I called Stan back. And then I got a letter from him, and then I got a letter from Dot, and then Nell, bless her heart, called me. They couldn't have chosen a finer hostess for me. As she said, as soon as I found out that she was in service and obviously dedicated and committed, she's my kind of lady. And her friend Winnie, we've spent many hours together, and we have other things in common. We all love to eat, you know. And we've been eating oysters and chocolate cookies and things like that. You heard last night my sobriety date, and it seems that as of last night I had the most sobriety of anybody here in this room. And I believe in length of sobriety. I'm not one who believes that the fellow who woke up this morning is the most sober. I don't believe that if you have got up at 5 o'clock and I got up at 6, that you're more sober than I am. I really don't. I believe in time. I believe in time. Time takes time. My name is Harriet Rawls. I am an alcoholic, and I'm a member of the Coral Gables group. Hi, everybody. My sobriety date, again, January 14th, 1956. That will be 31 years in this coming January. And 31 years ago, right now, I was in a mental institution. No one else wanted me. And I was drying out in a mental ward of the Veterans Hospital in Salisbury, North Carolina. We were getting ready for the Christmas play. And the Christmas play in a mental institution is very interesting. In between rehearsals, we played bridge, and if you've ever played bridge with 3 other dummies, it's interesting. I was King Herod. We had beautiful costumes for the play. I had a red robe and a crown. And I guess I still had my sense of humor because I can remember Dr. Rogers, the wonderful female doctor who understood something about alcoholism back 31 years ago. And she said, if you laugh, I'll kill you. So I went on to do my thing. But the highlight of the whole thing was 2 of our shepherds escaped Christmas Eve. Salisbury is not that big a town, and I've often, I think at Christmas time about that. Friend of the citizens were looking out their window that night. They really might have gotten a... They wouldn't have known what those two shepherds were doing running down the street. I also remember being taken out on a bus. We were lined up sometimes like school kids, and we were going on an outing. And two by two, we'd go down the hall, we ladies from the Ward A. I started out in Ward D, and I graduated to Ward A, the good ward. And we would go down to the, it was a school type bus, and they rode us around to show us the Christmas decorations. And I know nothing about Salisbury to this day, except the inside of the Veterans Hospital, but there must be a lot of water up there, because I remember the reflections of the Christmas lights. And I was like a little kid. I had my nose pressed up against the window, and it was cold, and making frost on the windows, and I'd do little pictures, and I was like a little kid looking out at all the Christmas lights shining on the water. And I knew in my heart of hearts that this was the way it was going to be the rest of my life. I was going to be locked up in somebody's metal ward because I was unacceptable to society. And I would be riding around on somebody's bus enjoying other people's Christmases and Easters and holidays vicariously, because I never would be able to live in society again. I knew that. I'm an only child. Many of us are. But I hear it from the podium, only children. And I was a loved child. Love and be loved. My parents adored me. My father, of course, the little girl. And I loved my parents. I knew nothing about child abuse. I knew nothing about those things. It was a happy home. My father made money. He was a self-made man, self-educated. My mother was a very well-educated woman. And because of these two things, they wanted me to have the education that my father never had, and my mother wanted me to have an even better one than she had. And I had a good education. I studied to be a school teacher. We lived out in the country in those days. Today it's part of the big city, but in those days it was the country. It was a lovely home. And I went to school in the city. And I was one of those kids that never felt quite at ease. I was just as good as they were. My father was else. And our little social circle was the same kind of social background, but I never felt part of. And living in the country, I didn't have too many playmates, and I grew up with my adult parents and their adult friends. And they let me stay up late at night, and once in a while if they had a highball. We didn't have much liquor in our home. The liquor was kept in the medicine cabinet. And I was 8, 9, 10 years of age, and I can remember the bootlegger coming. And I don't think that little kids, 8, 9, 10, usually remember the name of Andy Bittenbender, but that was the name of the bootlegger. And he brought the booze in a brown bottle, and it had the name Rittenhouse on it, and which is a famous name in the Philadelphia area. I'm from Pennsylvania originally, Wilkes-Barre area, born in Kingston on the Susquehanna River. And I would smell that bottle and I would giggle. I reacted to alcohol immediately. And when my folks would say about 11 or 12 o'clock at night, let's go down to Hoddle's and have some lobster and steamed clams, that packed up the kid, and I went too. And they gave me a little glass of brown stuff and it was bitter. And they said, drink this, it will help you digest the clams. It was medicine. It sure was. I believe that I was alcoholic from the beginning. I believe that alcohol entering into my system just triggered it, and I was instant alcoholic. From the time of that first drink of alcohol, that beer or ale, whatever it was, it became an obsession. Now, I didn't become a falling down drunk at that age, but my ears would go every time I heard booze in any kind of context. A highball, and my daddy let me sip his. And I would know what to do. I'd dance a little bit, and I would I no one had to tell me that booze changed my personality. I knew it, and I loved it. My second drink was for medicinal purposes. I was 15 years old and getting ready to go to college that year. It was in the summer. We were at the cottage in the mountains. And in September, I was to go to be a freshman in college in Washington, D.C. And I got the measles. And our family doctor prescribed a little port wine to get my strength back. That's what he did. And my father never knew what a little port wine was. I believe Daddy was a potential alcoholic. He brought the bottle to me. Came back a few hours later, I had drunk it all. And I had vomited, I was sick, I had passed out. And when I came to, I said, God, wasn't that good? So many of the fellows were what we called then, I guess you still call them, PKs. Preacher kids, preacher's kids. And many of them were having their little last swing before they went off. And if someone mentioned, let's get a little bottle, it was still, I hate to mention this, but there was still prohibition. And very unworldly, and rather, I'd been brought up in a rather puritanical fashion, particularly by my grandmother, with whom I spent many hours. Every Sunday was spent with my grandmother. She was superintendent of the Sunday school for 60 years, and every Sunday I sat in Sunday school, and in church I sat and drew little things while the service was going on. And then I was baptized in that church. And over these drinking years, when I was away, and not only physically, but emotionally and spiritually, I lost all the values that I was taught at that time. And 2 years ago, since I'm sober, to Pennsylvania, but 2 years ago, my cousin and I went to that church. And I saw the baptismal fountain. I remembered sitting in the back row. But one of the stained glass windows, and it's a large one, had been put there by my parents in memory of my grandmother. And my first thought was, well, why didn't my stained glass window here? And I thought, well, why should she have told me? I was not her daughter at that time. I was out there in the wilderness. Another kind of person, not the kind of little girl that I'd been brought up to be. I was brought up to be a lady. I was sent to dancing school. I was sent to their dancing school not only to learn to dance, but we're sent there to learn our manners and to wear nice clothes and to wear white gloves and the black patent leather Mary Jane shoes and to behave ourselves. And one of the things I learned the hard way was how to conduct yourself on a date. 13 years old and going to dancing school, and we had our little boyfriends, and their parents, of course, would be the chauffeurs, but Freddie would call and say, may I take you to the dance? We were being trained for the future, you know. It's ironic that he was one of my first dates. And Freddie called for me with a chauffeur-driven car. And he got out of the car and opened the door for me and went in, and we went to the dance together. And then at intermission time, we all went two blocks. We walked two blocks from the high school gym to the ice cream parlor. Nothing has changed. We still go to the ice cream parlor. And you went with the little boy that had invited you, and you had ice cream with Freddie. And then you went back to the dance, and you danced the first and last dance with him, and then you danced with other little boys in the meantime. And then when everything was over, you went home with Freddie, because he was the guy who was your date that evening. And one night, I was dancing with Mark. And intermission time came, and Mark says, come on, we're going. And I went for ice cream, and pretty soon Freddie came, and he says, you're supposed to have an ice cream with me. And the next day, we were lectured by our parents that you go for ice cream, and you go home with the guy what brung you. And this was to come in pretty great for me in later years, because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a little trouble finding God. And I searched for your God because I wanted to be spiritual like you were. Everyone that looked at me tried to absorb that spiritual feeling that I saw in you. Sometimes it turned out you were just sleepy, but There were certain people I latched on to. There's a gentleman here who remembers many of the old timers in Miami area. And one of them was a fellow named Ed Breeze. I hope that I won't use any last names except those who are deceased. I don't believe in breaking other people's anonymity. I can break mine, but please don't you break mine. This is my privilege. I can break mine at any level I choose, except at the level of press, radio, and films. Now, I've been sober almost 31 years, and really, no one has ever asked me to be in a film. They've never asked me to print for anything in the press. And certainly one time I was on radio, they wouldn't let me. But Ed Breeze conducted spiritual meetings in his home. We were having a run on 11-step meetings at that time. And I went to some of them, and I wanted to be like Ed. And I asked him what books he read, what church he went to, and there was another man and another lady, and they went to certain kinds of meetings, and I wonder what they... And I thought I had had a little spiritual experience, because 2 or 3 weeks after I stopped drinking and started going regularly to AA meetings, I was in the post office one day, and there was an advertisement for government workers, and one of them was to go to Alaska. Now, I'm 3 weeks sober, and I said, I got to make a lot of money. Broke, you know, I had a little money when I came to AA because my first husband had paid to get rid of me. And I was able to clear up most of my heavy debts, and I had a few bucks left over, and I thought, well, I'll go to Alaska because the pay was great, you know, like $1,500 a year back in those days. And I said, I'll go up there and make a whole bunch of money, and maybe I'll meet a live one, you know. And that was my motive. And so I went to MacDill Air Force Base, where, and I rode the bus up there. I didn't drink. I wasn't sober. I was just gone. And I applied for that job to go to Alaska, and I was interviewed, and I came back to Miami. They said they'd call me. And when they called me a few weeks later, and they said, okay, you've been accepted, I said, no, thank you. Because by that time, I had a few more weeks of sobriety, and I believe that I had been, because I said in that phone, and I don't remember saying it was, no, thank you, I think I'll wait a while. I'm not ready to go to Alaska. And I believe that that was a spiritual awakening at that time, and because the words did not come out of my mouth. They came from my heart. I knew I wasn't ready for that kind of experience, and I knew that my motives were wrong. And so I told a few people that, and they sort of looked at me, and so I thought, gee, that's not a real spiritual experience. That's not a real spiritual awakening, and I'm ashamed of it. It's too. So when I started looking for everybody else, and I wasted a whole bunch of years looking for your God and that God. By the 14th, 1956 was the morning I said, please, God, no more. And that was a little simple God of my Sunday school upbringing. What brung me to AA. And the book tells us we don't have to have a great big spiritual understanding. I think it's preposterous, but I think he understands me. To be loved by the God of my understanding. And so I stuck with a simple little God that helped me to say, no, I'm not going to go to Alaska. I went there about 2 years ago, and boy, am I glad I didn't go 30 years ago. Oh, my. I graduated college, and school teaching wasn't doing too well financially in those days, so I took a secretarial course at my mother's insistence. And I graduated from there and became a very good secretary, and that's what I've been all my life. And I got a government job, and I went to Philadelphia to work at the Philadelphia Quartermaster Depot down in South Philadelphia. And I left behind all the parental guidance, the parental management, the school teacher management, and I went to Philadelphia and I got me a new manager. And just like my parents and my school teachers, this new manager told me where to go, with whom to go the second and third and fourth times, and who not to go out with. That new manager was alcohol. Alcohol managed my life from the time I was 19 until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous at the age of 39. 20 years of being managed by alcohol. It was my higher power. Alcohol told me what to do and when to do it. To go over on Sundays because of the blue laws, we had to go over to New Jersey to drink, and it seemed a little odd to me. I was 20, 21 years old and had to go across the river every Sunday to drink. It seemed odd. And I thought, well, maybe I'm drinking too much. And I began to change drinking a different kind of booze, you know? And I switched to gin, straight gin. Oh, God. And I decided I better have a hobby. I thought, well, I'm drinking too much, I'll have a hobby. And I lived in a rooming house on the second floor over the front porch, and there was a roof. And I took up painting by the numbers. I have no talent whatsoever. I couldn't even read the numbers too well. But I would be painting by the numbers and trying not to drink. I had kitchen privileges, but because it was cold and I had a bay window, I could put my beer on the windowsill. And I remember the name of the beer. It was Gretz beer. And there was not small bottles. They were usually the quarts. And the windows would be open or cracked, or big crack, to keep the beer cold. And I'd be painting and with my turpentine and my beer. And God knows why I didn't mess them up. And one evening as I reached over for one of those cold beers, I knocked it out of the window and it rolled down through the snow and the ice on that slanty roof. And there were several more there. But it was automatic. I just went right out the window and down that slanty, slidey roof to retrieve that bottle of Gretz beer. And I was 21, perhaps, 20, 21. I was thin. And I retrieved it, and I turned around, and I found that it was more difficult coming back up through the snow and the ice. And I was not concerned so much for my own safety as I was for the safety of this silly bottle of beer. And it occurred to me that this was not social drinking. But it was a very fleeting thought. I was so involved with self. Our book tells us that self-centeredness, selfishness, we think, is the root of all our problems. And being an only child, I had been spoiled. Not spoiled rotten, but spoiled. And I was self-centered, and the whole world centered around me. And I was completely ignorant of what was going on in the world. We're coming into 1939, 1940. I didn't know what was going on. And the Philadelphia Quartermaster Depot decided to transfer its school down to Camp Lee in Petersburg, Virginia, and some of us ladies were invited to go along. And it never occurred to me that we were going to... But I went for the fun of it, and the money, and the excitement. And I had a wonderful time. And the young bachelor officers were instructed to make sure that the ladies had a good time because they didn't want us running home to Philadelphia or Pennsylvania, wherever we came from. They needed us. And so we were given good times, and all of our entertainment was on the base, officers, clubs, swimming, dancing. And that was a good day, as long as I didn't drink too much. But I was undependable. And the fellas would tell me, now don't drink like you did last Saturday night. Act like yourself. Act like a lady. Drink like a lady. Nobody ever told me how to do that. I was alcoholic and I did not know it. I was full blown and I didn't know it. And there were nights of a wonderful time in my early 20s. And I'd think, now gee whiz, this is the way it would be. And the next time I would go out and I'd say, well now last time I drank this, I ate mashed potatoes, and I drank some milk. I even took the castor oil and coated my stomach. I tried all those things, but I never could make sure what was going to happen. I never knew when I was going to disgrace and humiliate other people and myself. And I became quite unpopular. And I began to be absent a lot. And then I realized that there was a war on. December the 7th came along. And with Pearl Harbor, and it was a real war. I didn't take it too seriously. I thought, like in the movies, it would be over in 2 hours. But it wasn't, and my absenteeism got worse, and they couldn't depend upon me for that. One day, I remember one of my bosses said to me, "Do you think tomorrow you could type more than one page?" Because my hands were shaking in the mornings if I was there, and I couldn't do very good work. And so they threatened me with demotion back into a stenographic pool. Not back into one. I'd never been in one. I was always the first-class administrative assistant type. So when they threatened with putting me into a stenographic pool, I knew that wasn't my cup of tea, and I'd better get out of there. Besides which, they were drinking too much, and it was causing my problems. And so I decided I'd better join this man's army. They were recruiting ladies for the WACS, Women's Army Corps. And in my extreme ego, which of course covered up that terrible inferiority complex that so many of us have, I decided not to join the army because they would demand my immediate return to Camp Lee to help them run their poor old camp. And I didn't want to be in that, have that much authority. So I discarded the idea of joining the Women's Army Corps. And I looked into the other ones, and I decided that I wanted to be a Marine. The Marines had the snazziest uniform, and they had olive drab uniform with a red ascot tie, and I loved red. I was a brunette, and red was my color, and their caps had a red cord around the front, red silk cord, and I said, "That's my uniform," and that was my motive for joining the Marine Corps. And the morning that I couldn't make it to work and I had to go to Richmond to do this, I had found out where to go, and I was so sick, and by the time I rode the bus up to Richmond, I was even sicker. But I was in my early 20s still, middle 20s, and I was able to shake it off, and I was able to look good. And you know how we smile on the outside and we're dying on the inside. And that's what was happening to me that morning. And I walked into that place to enlist in the Marine Corps. And I walked in trying to smile. And they had to sign a lot of papers. And by this time, my hand wasn't too good. And my arm would go shooting off beyond my control. I'd go to sign my name and whoop! And so I'm concentrating. I'm holding my hand so I can sign my name. And pretty soon he swore me in, and then he shook my hand and he said, "Welcome to the United States Navy." And I told him, I said, "Sir, I came here to join the Marine Corps." And he said, "Honey, you got off on the wrong floor, and you are in the Navy now." And he insisted that I go to officer training school because he said, "With your education and your background, you will make us a fine leader." Well, honey, I never made anybody a fine leader until you all let me be a trusted servant. And oh, what a trust that was when you all made me delegate in 1977. I said, "This poor little old lady who couldn't even get in the right Army or Navy or the Marine Corps." But you see, it didn't matter what I got into, because when the chips were down and push came to shove back there in 1955 and nobody wanted me, it was the Veterans Hospital said, "We'll take them." And they didn't care whether I'd been in the Marines or the Army or the officer or a private or what. I thought that I'd known an admiral one time, and he had to go to Bethesda Naval Hospital, and they gave him a penthouse. And because I'd been a lieutenant junior grade, I thought, well, at least a private room, you know? No way. We were all in there together, and I'm so grateful. Some of those ladies are still there. I spoke up there in that area, and the director of the Veterans Hospital is a member now of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he came up and he said, "Some of those ladies are still there." I said, "I know." And I said, "I remember their faces. I remember them well." They were nurses mostly. And they had seen active duty. And many of them were sick with venereal diseases of the brain. And they were there permanently. They were insane. And when they were not quite as bad as other times, they were lovely ladies. And I think of them often because I could have stayed there too. Riding around on that bus is a memory to me, too. Christmas time comes, and I said, I can drive my own car now. I can have my own Christmas tree light. because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, if we waves were not allowed to go overseas in those days, we were there to help you fellows go. And we stayed home and took care of the bookwork or whatever we did. And so when I got out on points, and I was a little jealous of some of my friends who had gone, I was down the Pentagon building one day, and there was a big sign, recruiting. And off I went to North Africa. Right after World War II, that was a lovely place for a female alcoholic to be. Wild and Woolly and Casablanca and Algiers. Charles Boyer was hanging out at the windows, you know. Humphrey Bogart hadn't gotten there yet, I don't think. But I romanticized the whole deal. And well, I should, because I fell madly in love with an Arab. Not just any old Arab. My Arab was a chieftain. He had a title. He was called a Kaid. Now, the Kaid is like a mayor. And he was the Kaid of an oasis south of Algiers, and the oasis was called Busada. And I went with my Arab down to Busada, and we rode a sunset into the sunset. I'd seen a lot of movies, and I knew this was going to be the way it was forever. I was going to have a tent of my own with Persian rugs on the floor and a little boy over here pulling the fan, and the fan would be over me, you know. And somebody was going to be feeding me grapes. Well, the State Department frowned on this, and I was ordered back. And as we rode our camels back into the city of Algiers, or back to the oasis of Busada, my Arab was... I wish I could remember his name. He was wearing a garment called a burnous. A burnous is a cape like affair with a hood on it. And to me, it was the most glamorous thing in the whole world. It just was so beautiful, and it just floated along as their camels floated too. And I'm riding along, and I coveted that burnous. And it's fortunate, because he wanted my navy raincoat. And we traded. And when the State Department sent me home, they did things very nicely in those days, still do, I guess, and they sent me home first class on a very lovely liner, and I used my burnous as an evening wrap. And I flung it about and flirted, and I held it, you know, I thought I was a spy. I In a moment of some kind of truth, I looked one day at this burnous, and it was not made. It wasn't the graceful, lovely, gorgeous garment. It was made of brown wool. It had moth holes in it. It was gritty and sandy. The Arabs used these to wrap up sick goats, and this one had been around a lot of goats. And camels. And it stunk. I don't know what ever happened to that thing. When I was in the mental hospital in 1955, 30 years ago right now, I was dry for the first time in years. I was a daily drinker, weekend drunk, sometimes Monday night drunk, Tuesday night drunk. But I had the opportunity to be in a hospital where I didn't drink. And I sat there wondering, what am I doing here? How did I get here? How did a nice lady like me get to a place like this? And I began what I believe today to be a fourth-step inventory. I believe we all take some kind of inventory, or we wouldn't even come here. I believe we take a pretty good look at ourselves if we come to Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't come here for diaper rash, you know? We don't come here because we got a little headache. We don't come here because we've got a little hangover. Hangover. That's a word. Oh, you know, a hangover. I had some, that wasn't big enough for what I had. You know, I hurt from the tip of my toenails to the roots of my hair. Hangover, that's a mild word. That's the school teachers who wake up one Saturday morning and do it. But I looked at myself back there in that hospital, and I compared myself to that Bernice. I thought my life up to this point had been so glamorous, and I'd had such a great time. And I did. I did, ladies and gentlemen. I've had a lot of fun, believe me. And I don't regret any of it. I'm glad I did it then. I couldn't do it today. But I thought about that burnoose, and I thought, my life was like that burnoose. It was dirty. It was brown. It was black. It was full of holes. And I'd been around too many dirty people and dirty things. And I hated it. And I'd heard about Alcoholics Anonymous, and that wonderful Dr. Rogers invited some of the folks from the Salisbury group to come and talk to us. There were several other ladies who claimed they had a problem with alcohol, but they weren't as interested as I was. They were more interested in the Christmas play. And it was an exciting thing, as I've told you. But I was going to... It was already being rumored that I would be released right after the first of the year. And I was getting very comfortable in that institution. They told me what time to get up, what time to go to bed. They told me what time to eat. We had OT, PT, HT. And if you haven't been there, you know what all those T's stand for. The one I loved, OT, I made all occupational therapy. I did all the things I was asked to do. I made little ashtrays. I made a leather belt. I gave it to my psychiatrist with whom I fell in love because I heard that was what you were supposed to do. I did everything you told me to do. And hydrotherapy, that was great. You just lay in a tub and let the warm water wash all over you. There are days when I would love to be back there, lying in that tub, you know. Some of the hectic days in these 30 years, I would love to be back there. And PT, I wasn't very good at physical therapy. They let me be the pin setter. I was a terrible bowler. So they let me set the pins. And I thought that was kind of neat. And I got into the routine and I loved it. And they were, it was comfortable. And they were all locked out. I wasn't locked in, you know. Those people out there, I was afraid of them. I didn't know how to live with them. That's why I was there. And I had gone over this in that little inventory that I did, and I was scared to death to leave. So when the time came on January the 9th, on Monday morning, and they said, okay, this is it. They'd had a staff meeting, you'd go before staff. And I was frightened, and they said, go out there, and we'll send you some money when you've got a bank account. And they gave me a little money. And this first husband, I had married him. I loved what Benoit said, you know, in those days we shacked up. And this wasn't even a meaningful relationship. I had met this fellow over in Italy, and he was a merchant marine captain, and his purser had had appendicitis, and he found out I'd been in the supply corps, and he signed me on as the purser. Now, merchant marine ships are not supposed to do that. They have rules and regulations and marine things to go by. And he got court-martialed. And we shacked up for a long time. And I followed him up and down the East Coast whenever his ship came in to Baltimore. Oh, Baltimore. Oh, my. I'd go into Brooklyn, and his ship would come in there. And we used to stay at the old St. George Hotel. And that's where some of the early AA meetings were held. And at one time, my husband said he'd gotten there a day or so earlier than I had. And we were sitting in the bar, where else? And he said, see that group of people over there? And I said, yeah. And there was this happy, laughing bunch of people going into one of the small rooms off the lobby. He says, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. I says, no kidding. That's not what I said, but that's what, yeah. You know, I don't have to use that kind of language anymore. I don't. I can express myself without using that kind of language. And I once in a while I do it, I think, as a shock value, when I'm, particularly when I'm talking to the younger people, and I pull out one of these dumb words that we used back there 30 years ago, and it doesn't bother them a bit, but it shocks the hell out of me. Because what I used to say is nothing compared to what they say today. But in any event, he says, you want to go to that meeting? I said, no, what do I want to go there for? He says, they're nice people. They're nice people. And he says, they talk about staying sober. And he says, you know, they put dollar bills in the basket. It's not like church where they put nickels and dimes in. And think about that. That was 31, 32, 33 years ago. We were putting dollar bills in the basket. We've had inflation 10 times over, and some of us are still putting $1 bills in the basket. Your group's rent has gone up. Your coffee has gone up. All your electricity has gone wise. Put in $2 or $3 when you can afford it, particularly your home group. I can't do it at every group that I go to because I visit a lot of groups. But in my own home group, you know, once in a while I put in a $5 or a $10, particularly if somebody's looking. The last train trip. We had trains in my day. Did any of you ever drink in a Pullman car? Oh, boy. Oh, yeah, good for you. Isn't that fun? Oh, boy. So they sent me off on my way to, don't drink so much, they said. Well, it was a long journey because I drank. I left there on Monday morning, January the 9th, 1956, and I was resentful because they had only given me $100 or whatever it was. I was resentful because I didn't know how to cope. I didn't know what to do. A few AA people had come, had shared some, but I was not able to hear it. And the train stopped in some city, and we had to change trains. And I got off the train, and I bought a bottle. And I believe people when they say they don't remember taking that drink, because I don't remember doing it. I don't remember buying the bottle. I do remember coming back into the ladies' room of that railroad station and lifting the bottle out of the bag and lifting it to my lips. And I can see my face right this moment. It was drawn taut and like little ticks, you know, and nervous. And I was shaking in anticipation. And the phenomenon of craving that Dr. Silkworth talks about had set in because mentally I was drunk. Mentally I was drunk already and I had not yet taken the drink, but I had the craving. And nobody else but an alcoholic can understand that. One alcoholic can talk to another. Let's not, Dr. Bob said, keep it simple. Let's not louse it up. Let's keep it with alcoholics. This is a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Let's not get into the dope addiction that they tried back there in those early days. Bill Wilson writes, we dreamed those dreams. We thought we'd have a lot of hospitals and we would deal with dope addiction and social problems and we would have education and schools and teach everybody. We would cure all the ills of the world, even the politicians. We were going to get make them honest. Believe it or not, you know, Bill was a dreamer, wasn't he? And it was Dr. Bob who said, let's keep it simple, the things. And so I'm standing there in that ladies' room with the bottle and just shaking and the drank it. And I said to myself, I must be crazy. And I was to read these words in Bill's story when he took that last drink. And he said, I must be crazy. And the man at the bar said to him, after what you've told me about your drinking and you've taken that drink, you must be crazy. And Bill said, I am. And that's the way I felt that morning. And I hadn't read Bill's story. I hadn't read anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew a little bit about the program, that it was a place where nice people went and didn't drink anymore. And so I knew I was crazy because here I'd been locked up for 4.5 months in somebody's mental ward and I was drinking what I knew had gotten me into the hospital in the first place, and I knew I was crazy. And I admitted that I was powerless over this great big bottle. It was like Alice in Wonderland, and I got smaller and smaller and the bottle got bigger and bigger. And I said, my God, alcohol is bigger than I am. And my life is a complete mess. And on January the 14th, I was going to be 39 years old, and I said, my God, I'm 39 years old, and I have nothing to show for my life. My life is a mess. And I decided, right then and there, I had taken the drink, and the craving was going, and I had to have another drink, and another drink, and another drink, but I decided that I would turn my life and my will over to this group of people called Alcoholics Anonymous, because they didn't drink, and they were more powerful than I was, and that was my higher power. And I had to drink until I came to Miami the Saturday morning, January the 14th, and that last night, the Friday the 13th, was the luckiest day of my life because I was so sick. And if you've ever drunk on a train and you're on that lower berth and the train is shaking and the water's down there in a stinky old tank and you got a bottle and a cap and there's no place to set the cup and it's got a pointy end on it and you got to use your teeth to get the top off. It was my 39th birthday and I've been sober 30 years. So you can't add, that's your problem. I was old. I was an old lady. I was broken down. I was an old woman. I was no lady. And that's why I came to you, because I wanted to be a young lady. I wanted to be a gracious lady. And you have helped me to become one. I went to my AA meetings, and I said, I have to get a job. And they said, not yet. And I said, I've got to find my own apartment. I had a cousin who lived in Miami, and she took me in. I said, I have to get my own apartment. And they said, not yet. I said, look at that cute fellow over there. Not yet. But unbeknownst to them, I didn't pay much attention to that one. And I don't advise this, but it happened to me, and it's part of my story, and it's important. I married that cute fellow. I had less than 5 months sobriety. He told me he'd been around the program for 16 years. Oh, pretty good, huh? Brand new lady. This fella, 16 years. Now, I don't remember them talking much about sponsorship in those days, and I've never had a sponsor. I do not advise this either. I believe in sponsorship. And I believe in talking to the old-timers, and I believe in going by the experience and strength and hope of the old-timers. And I used a lot of people as role models, and they were sponsors in their way, but I never went up to anyone formally in that. And years later, I said to people like Ed Breeze, why did you let me do it? He says, we couldn't have stopped you. We couldn't have stopped you. And I don't think they could have. I was so starved for love, what I thought was love. I was starved for sex. I was wanting to be loved. And I was incapable of loving. And I don't know that I was capable of being loved. But I'm so grateful because my Bob taught me a lot about love. He was a good man. And if he had been around 16 years, but he'd never had a year of sobriety in his life. He was a slipper, and he died drunk in 1973. We had 14 years of marriage. And I didn't know that after you came in. I really did not know that once you became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, that you were allowed to go out and drink. That was against the rules. And so when after we'd been married about 6 months, and he began to be irritable, restless, discontented, and he got drunk, I thought he was kidding me. I came in the house, the apartment one evening, and there sprawled out on the couch with a half pint, empty. And I thought he was playing a trick on me. Sick kind of joke. But from then on, he never had a year's sobriety. Once he had a year of sobriety, just about, give or take a few days. But Bob Ross taught me much about this program. You see, I thought I could fix him. Because I could stop drinking, I thought he could too. He knew this book. He could get up and make the best AA talk. Fresh out of the Miami Sanitarium, and he'd tell you how to say so. He could talk the talk with a silver tongue, but he never could walk the walk. And I nearly died trying to protect him, and I enabled him, and I lied for him. And I went to Al-Anon. And the Al-Anon tried to help me, and we had a very small group at that time. And Al-Anon is not, if it's big now, I don't know about it, but at that time it never did flourish too much in those early days. And they didn't really give me much help. They tried, God bless them. But they kept using that word I didn't like, and the word was detach. I didn't understand it, but I didn't like the word. And I didn't go very much, and I keep running back to my AA people. And I believe, you know, I have right in front of me now the excerpt from AA Way of Life. And there was a letter that Bill wrote back in 1954 called After the Honeymoon. He says, for most of us, the first years of AA are something like a honeymoon. And this is where I was with my honeymoon. I was staying sober. I had not yet begun to put the principles of the steps into my life. And it says, when the honeymoon is worn off, we are obliged to take our lumps. And these were my lumps. My husband couldn't stay sober, and I was doing the lie and all the things that you, ladies and gentlemen of Al-Anon, have done. And I'd come home, and he'd be drunk, and I'd see the booze on the kitchen sink and the cigarettes and the burnt pillows. And thank God he put them in the bathtub where they smoldered. And Milltown was the big thing in those days. And he was getting those from the doctors and the hospitals. And I took a few of them myself because I wanted out. But they never did for me what they just seemed to do for other people. They just put me to sleep. And I didn't want to sleep. I wanted out, but I didn't want to sleep. I guess I wanted to watch things as they went along. So they said that if you mix pills and booze, it'll kill you. So one day I was so desperate, and I took the pills, and I put them right next to the booze bottle, and I figured, well, he'll take the pills, and he'll put them in there, and he'll pour the booze, and he'll drink it, and he'll be dead. I didn't want him dead. I wanted him well. And then I went in the other room and waited for him to do this. And he didn't do it, and didn't do it, and then I began to think, well, he'll be dead, and I'll be in jail. And I didn't like those consequences. And so I ran back, and I got the pills, and I took them and hid them, and so... another night he was playing in the water, in the bathroom, and he turned the water on to such an extent that I couldn't get it off. Now, there was a certain tool in the house I've never known what it was for, I don't know to this day, but it's called water pump pliers. Well, you got running water, you go get the water pump pliers, right? So I went and got them, and I stood there, and I didn't know what to do with them. The water's running all over the bathroom. He's swimming on the floor. So I lifted the pliers, and God, I meant to kill him. I really did. And only God stopped me. I called the cops. The cops came and turned the water off outside. I didn't know how to do that. I finally divorced Bob. He sunk to the lower companions, Annoy, and the drinking ladies. And I began to divorce him for the second or third time. And my lawyer was an AA member named Frank, and I would call it at all kinds of night hours, and poor Frank, he'd be waked up out of a sound sleep, and he'd say, go read page such and such. And he just pulled numbers out of the hat and he's sleepy, you know. But I'd go and read that page. And as you know, there is an answer on there. And I began to find the true meaning of the program, the principles, spiritually and usefully. And it's through the use of these principles that I have become pretty useful, pretty much of a whole person. I believe that's what AA is for, not to stop drinking. My God, anybody can stop drinking. The trick is to stay sober. And this is what we share with one another, how we stay sober. And when I went to my first meeting and everybody was laughing, and so many people this weekend have mentioned the power of laughter. Laughter is a healing thing, I believe. And when I first was able to laugh at myself, what a great thing that was. It tells us in one of the traditions, you know, the ability to laugh at oneself, deal with oneself. But here I was, unemployed and unemployable, and my life was over, and they were saying, not yet, not yet, not yet. But there was a job in the paper one day, and it said, temporary help wanted, one day at a time. And they said I could take that job. And I went to that job, and it was a public relations firm, and they were kind of new. They just started out, and one of their first clients was one of their school buddies, and a graduate attorney. And I went to that job, and they said, you won't have to do much today. Marge is sick, but, and we'll answer the telephones, but And if we need you, we'll call you. We just need you here in case something comes up. And I met this particular candidate, the state attorney, and they were talking the politics and getting ready for this campaign. It was the presidential election, you remember, Eisenhower. And I began to be interested in that. And I listened. And the next day, I went down and registered to be a voter. My parents had owned a little property, which they turned over to me way down in Florida City. It was valued property owner and eligible to be a voter. And I wanted to be a good citizen. And I think this is important. I began to be a citizen. And I have never missed an election. And I try to be an informed citizen. I read, I listen. I may not always be right, but I try. It's just like in our group conscience. You know, don't forget that word on page 99 of AA Comes of Age. An informed group conscience. Go to your group informed about what you're voting on. When I was very new and going to business meetings, I'd look around to see how that person was going to vote. And if I liked him, I'd vote the way he voted. I didn't know any better. I didn't know what the issues were. And I warn people today because I see some of the new ladies or the new guys watching me to see how I vote. I said, don't vote the way I do. Vote your conscience. Be informed. Find out what it's all about. This is how God expresses himself. This is how our groups run. This is how AA runs. God, as we understand him, is through our group conscience. That's what these delegates have been saying to you this weekend. And I'm a past delegate. And we go to New York and vote the group conscience of the United States and Canada. And I love that Bob Sang, and I heard Dave A. from Dallas, Texas say the same thing. The sun never sets today on Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in Buenos Aires just a few weeks ago, back in South America, and I went to meetings there. But one of the things they showed us in the port there, some of the big ships, the cargo ships, were going down to Antarctica. And I know that there's a group down there on the AA group in Antarctica. And I said, gee, maybe they're sending down some of this good South American coffee to our people in Antarctica. And from A to Z, you know, Zimbabwe, they got about 15, 16 groups in Zimbabwe. What a marvelous fellowship we have. The sun never does set. I keep losing my train of thought, but that's okay. And I like everybody else. I don't know what time it is, but I do. The talking to Frank and going through the different pages, I began to find out the value of our 12 steps. I had put these steps into my life in a haphazard kind of fashion. I am not one to stand up in front of a new gal or a fellow and say, you've got to take them one at a time. You've got to start with step one, because I didn't do it that way. One of my first conscious things was to take step 9. I had to make direct amends to my parents. I had to make direct amends to my employers. Automatically, I was ready. You see, I had taken some kind of an inventory back there in that hospital, and I had come into you on step 3. I was convinced, being convinced I was at step 3. I had admitted back there in that railroad station that I was powerless and that my life was unmanageable, that I was insane and I needed to be returned to sanity. And the insanity is not what I did drunk. The insanity was knowing what I knew and picking up a drink. And this is what the insanity to me means today. And this was the insanity of my husband. He knew all about Alcoholics Anonymous. He knew the consequences, and yet he would pick up that drink after 5, 6, 7, 8 months of sobriety or being dry. And Bob argued always up until the day almost that he died. If you're not drinking, you're sober. That's not true. Sobriety is threefold. It's a threefold illness, physical, emotional, and spiritual, and it must be a threefold recovery. And recovering is the word I like to use, but because I have not recovered. I am not cured. Depending upon my spiritual condition, there's a promise in the big book that's negative. It says, if we've let up on the maintenance of our spiritual condition, we may not recover. That's a promise. And all those promises say, if we do certain things, wonderful things will happen. And if we don't do them, we may not recover. It says in the fifth step, if we skip this vital step, we may not stop drinking. What are promises? If we don't do these things, I promise you, you're going to get drunk. And so I try to stay in fit spiritual condition. And about three months ago, we were having a big television drive on cocaine and showing the dangers of the cocaine. And I stayed home one night to watch this particular program, and the kids, young men and women, kids to me, kids to some of us, but they're young men and women, were telling me the ecstasies and the euphorisms that they get from the coke and how cheap it is. And they were telling us, and they were in recovery houses, but they were telling us the dangers of it and how one shot of this stuff and you're hooked. And I'm watching and listening, and I said, gee, I'd like to try that. Alcoholic mind. Don't tell me after 30 years I'm cured or recovered. I am still recovering. I still have an alcoholic mind, and I know it, and I doubled up on my meetings that week, I'll tell you. Scared me. I said, my gosh, I haven't thought like that in over 30 years. It's a recovering. But Frank would tell me to look these things up, and it's another place that AA Way of Life, Bill wrote a letter. And he wrote about the sobriety and how we're given three choices in the quest for freedom. And it says, a rebellious refusal to work upon our glaring defects can be an almost certain ticket to destruction. Or perhaps for a time we can stay sober with a minimum of self-improvement. And that's where I was. Perhaps for a time we can stay sober with a minimum of self-improvement and settle ourselves into a comfortable but often dangerous mediocrity. And I was there for 7 long years. And if you're there, please get out of it right now. Get yourself into this program. The program are the 12 steps. The 12 steps are. And this is what will give us sobriety. And this dangerous mediocrity that I was in, only this man who was there at the right time pushed me into these steps, and I began to stay sober. I had complained to some of the ladies in AA that no one had ever asked me to be their sponsor. We had a little lady named Claire, about 5 foot tall, and she drew herself up to her full 5 feet, and she said, did you ever think that you have nothing to give? But after I began to get into these steps and put these principles into my life, people began to ask me to sponsor them because I had something to give. And many of the ladies who come to me now are people who had problems with a drinking husband or a drinking mate. And Bob had other problems. Bob was one of these people with grave emotional and mental problems. And I debated on whether to talk about this. I never have from the podium. And for some reason, I have felt compelled since yesterday afternoon to tell you what some of his mental problems were. Bob was accused in 1964 of molesting the daughter of one of our friends. But because of his drinking, I had put him into the front bedroom. There's a line in the book that says, understatement of the year, it says, sex does complicate, drinking does complicate sex relations. And this was what happening in our home. Drinking was complicating the sex relations. And I put him in the front bedroom, and she felt that it was my fault that he was molesting a child. And I accepted that guilt for a while. I finally broke down and told his brother and found out that before I ever knew Bob, he had molested his niece. I went to a psychiatrist. I couldn't get him. I had to go to court and listen to my husband being criticized and condemned and sentenced. He had a good lawyer. He got out of it. But I went through that. I was in shock. I'm here to tell you that I have not had to drink. I have not always been happy in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I've tried to be cheerful. I try to put on a good front for the newcomers. And yet I don't want the newcomers to think that this all bowl of cherries. We have to say there are a lot of pits in the cherry bowl. And there have been some pits in mine. In 30 years, it's bound to be some. And if you're new, remember that some of the lumps are going to come along for you. And please be ready for them. If you haven't seriously gotten into the steps, don't tell me that you're in AA. Tell me that you're around the meetings and coming to meetings. If people come to me and say, well, I got drunk last week. And I said, well, how long have you been here? And he said, well, I've been in the program around for 2 or 3 years. You know, I said, well, you've never been in the program. You've never used the steps. Once we have accepted that first step, we're powerless over alcohol. We never have to drink again. You don't have to drink again. You have a choice from then on. But saying, getting into these steps and putting them into your lives will guarantee it. So I came to you on those third steps. I was convinced that I was alcoholic, and I went through that inventory, but not on a written one yet. But in my fifth step, I told my Bob everything. I spilled my guts to Bob Rawls. And coming home from a little picnic and where I had told him things that the 12 and 12 says I was going to take to my grave. I was never going to tell a living soul. And I had spilled it all to this man. And coming back, something funny happened on the bridge. And we were waiting for the drawbridge. And I started to giggle. And I began to giggle so hard that I doubled up with laughter. And the tears were coming down my cheeks. And I have to tell you, I wet my panties. But it was a belly laugh, and I want to tell you, if you haven't had a belly laugh lately, get yourself one. They're important. Someone says, well, they're not very dignified. Oh, dignified, schmignified, laugh! It's healing, it's healing. And I did write an inventory eventually. It wasn't much of one in the older days. I can't remember the 3x5 or 5x7 card, but it was awful small. But it was a start, it was a start. And then I remembered the inventory I'd taken back there in the hospital, and I was able to write some of these things down. I began to do this. And I, like so many people, for a while I didn't bother much with 6 and 7. You know, they weren't very important. And I went on to the important ones and made amends and became willing. And then somewhere along the line I found out that, you know, you get to get ready, get set, go thing. And I was ready to have these things removed from me. And when I became ready and willing, then I could humbly, on my knees, ask God to remove some of these things. Not all, I still like some of them. But I'm working on it, I'm working on it. And then we come to the 10th step where it says that, oh, I think I'd rather not do that one now. I'd rather talk about my Paggle. Sometime back, and I'll finish up with this because it's getting late. And I want to thank all of you for staying this morning. I didn't expect this many people to be here, and I really appreciate you being here. And has the sun come out yet? Oh, good. You can get going in just a few minutes, and I know you want to get home. Please drive safely, carefully, safely. But in this, the word that I heard a few years back is not a real word. It's a made-up word. It's called, it's PAGGLE. It's an acronym, and it's letters of the 7 deadly sins. P for pride, A for anger, G for gluttony, G for greed. You read these in our 12 and 12. L for lust, E for envy, and S for sloth. Paggles. Is it the made-up word? And I liked it. And some of those defects of character. Pride, of course, leads the list. And then one day I was going to chair a meeting, fourth or fifth step, and I thought, I'll use the Paggles, but I don't want to talk so negative. I'll write down some affirmative Paggles. And I came up with a few ones, and you can do it too if you like them. But I began to think about the positive words that begin with the P, and of course the first one I thought about was principles. To practice these principles in all our affairs, hospitals, and now I can have patients to grow. And peace, peace of mind. Wonderful words that begin with the P, and make progress. This is a program of progress, spiritual progress. We don't any of us have to get better than the other fellow. There's no competition. And neither Bill nor Dr. Bob was any better or any worse than the rest of us. We're all equal, and that's part of the anonymity, that none of us is better than the other. And so the progress, spiritual progress, and oh my goodness, prayer. The power of prayer. Just think of all these marvelous words that you can use with a positive Paggle. And the program itself, we're never striving for perfection, we're just striving for progress. And then that A for anger, we can turn that around into our attitude. And before I forget it, let me tell you, this program is very, very simple. All you have to do, if you're new, all you have to do is you don't drink, and you come to these meetings, and change your whole life. That's all. Change your whole life. And so you change our attitudes. A for attitude, and then accept it. God grant me the strength to accept the things I cannot change. I cannot change the fact that I'm an alcoholic, so I must change me to fit into the world, the real world. And awareness and the awakening, the spiritual awakening. Oh my goodness, how many we have during the years that we're sober, because we keep awakening all the time, this slow educational kind that William James talked about. Few of us have that great big spiritual flash, that hot flash that they wanted Bill to talk about all the time. Don't tell us about those traditions. Tell us about your hot flash. And the abundance of things that we find here in the appreciation, becoming alive, becoming alert, all those wonderful A words. And then G for gluttony. we talk about gratitude. This is the month of gratitude here in the United States because it's Thanksgiving time. Last month in October it was Canada. And we're growing. This is what the G stands for, growing, growth. And being generous, generosity, not just generous with our buck or three, $2 or $3 or $10 if somebody's looking, you know, but be generous with your time. Someone comes up to talk to you, listen. Someone asks you to help them, listen and share. Generosity with your time and generosity with your love. And I love what June said last night. If you like everybody, you haven't been to enough meetings. I love that, June. Thank you. But we do love everybody because we care. The common welfare. We care about one another, how we fare. And that L for lust I've learned. And thank God for Bob Rawls. He taught me about physical love. And I know what it is to be happily married. It wasn't a long time, but I know what it is to be a wife and to have a husband and to have a lover and to have the wonderful advantages of having a home. And I have that home today. It'll be paid for in another 2 years. And it's wonderful. He was a good man. And when he died, I miss him terribly. I miss him. I'm still lonely. But I don't have to be alone with my loneliness. But I learned about life, and I learned about love, and I love you all, and I know you love me, and I'm capable of being loved. Now, it was a hard thing for me to be capable of accepting your love. I kind of backed away from that. And I came from one of those homes where we didn't have much demonstrative love. And I backed away a few times in those early days from the hugs and the kisses. But now I'm one of the best huggers that comes, you know. And the E for envy. And I like the word emancipation. It's another word for freedom. The new freedom that talks about in the big we had. And the energy, the enthusiasm for the E's. And the S for sloth. And this is one of my biggies. I'm very slothful in the mind. I'm lazy. I'm not a big, heavy student. But step by step, I regained my sanity and serenity and self-respect. Oh, self-respect, that's so important. And I didn't tell you about self-esteem because when I took that job one day at a time, they asked me to come back the next day. And I said, I can come back one more day, yeah. And one day at a time, I stayed there 14 years, you know. And I got my self-esteem back. And I began to be proud of the work I do. And be proud of your work. There's nothing wrong with that kind of pride. Don't put yourself down. So many times, I think we imagine ourselves to be much worse than we were. Particularly we ladies, I think. It tells us in the little pamphlet, of Member's Eye View, first we tell the newcomer that we have an illness. Don't be ashamed. You're not a bad person. And then we say take a moral inventory, you know? And it says that we have to do this because we feel guilty. And we have to confess because we feel guilty and we have to get rid of what we felt. And I felt much worse than I think I actually was. And even to this day, I know I wasn't as bad as I thought I was. Or sometimes I make myself out to be, but it was the way I felt inside. And so then that S for self-esteem and service. Oh, now please stay in service. And those of you who have not been in service, try it. You'll like it, really. If you can stick through 2 years of GSR, come on, you can go to DCM and then on up or over or whatever on that chart. Laughter. The book says we're not a glum lot. We absolutely insist upon enjoying life. And I got to tell you, I think that AA is, dare I say it, a lot like sex. If you're not enjoying it, you're not doing it right. Next July, 8th, 9th, and 10th, Miami will host the Florida State Convention. It will be held at the Hyatt Regency Hotel in downtown Miami, not to be confused with the city of Miami Beach. If you haven't been to Miami in recent years, we have a vibrant, new, wonderful city. We have skyscrapers and lights and metro rail and people movers, and please come. July 8th, 9th, and 10th, 1987, the Hyatt Regency, your state convention, those of you who come from Florida and our neighboring states are invited. Drive safely. I love you. Thank you, Stan. Thank you, Doc. Thank you, ma'am.
Can we have this a minute?
I have a few more words to say and a couple of announcements, so if you will bear with us a few more minutes and we'll be finished for this time. I would like to tell you that there's a lot of popcorn to be taken away. They're bagging it up right now. Please go by the coffee room and get all the popcorn you want. That's one thing. And from Dot, please register early next year when you get your notices for this roundup. It'll be very good if you go to the post office the same day and send in your registration. And from the roundup too, please drive carefully on the way home. We want to see you all back here next year. And what else was there? If your cup isn't running over for this weekend, then there's something the matter with you. And in closing, I know this was read once before, but Stan and I agreed that we should read it again. In closing, I would like to read this. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what he can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answer will come. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you all. Let's close this one. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.